Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the No Bad Dogs podcast with me, Tom Davis, the podcast where we love, live, and work with dogs. And today we have a very special guest on, Zach Scow. Is it Scow or Scow?
Scow.
Scow. I knew I was going to butcher that. Zach Scow, and Zach is the founder, if I'm correct, of Marley's Mutts.
Yep.
Cool, man. So Zach does many, many, many different things from my understanding. This is one of our first times really sitting down and talking with each other. And I've heard such fabulous, great things about this human being, not only on the dog level, but on every other level. So welcome, Zach. Thanks for being on. And why don't you just tell me a little bit about what you do right now currently in the dog world?
Oh, boy. We do a lot in the dog world. So Marley's Mutts Dog Rescue, which is our the primary organization,
yeah,
which I founded in 2009.
Wow.
After a bout with liver disease. I was in liver failure in 2008 through 2009.
And jeez.
Part of my recovery of getting, you know, into a transplant program, getting through my recovery and my rehabilitation was all around dogs. So I was very suicidal. I was very addicted. I was very much alcoholic, and I didn't know how to put one foot in front of the other, or even begin how to understand where to start to try and live again without all of the vices that I've had, without the self-loathing that I carried with me everywhere. So my dogs really helped me literally put one foot in front of the other and start to walk, help me start to get my mind focused on something other than all these this dangerous poison that was happening in between my ears. And that's how Marley's Mutts started. It was just me fostering dogs. I'd been working with the Humane Society for 3 years prior. And when I, you know, got out of the hospital, spent a couple months in the hospital, when I got out, it was just fostering dogs to keep my mind on something other than wanting to kill myself, you know, other than focused on the way I looked, the way I felt. You know, I was yellow and 140 pounds and I had, you know, a catheter in my back, and I was just a sick dude, you know. And
wow.
So we just started with fostering. It was just I just surrounded myself with dogs and tried to get up and walk and do all those things I needed to do to qualify for a liver transplant, you know. And
wow. So let me just, that's a lot. Let me back up just a little bit so I can, you know, not only for anybody out there that wants to hear your story, but for myself as well. Let me back up just a little bit. So you had liver failure, because was it just like a disease that you
acute
had?
Acute alcoholic hepatitis. So okay. I drank myself until liver failure at 28
wow.
years old.
20?
I started at 28.
Oh.
So I started to turn yellow. I started to, my belly started to swell up, a condition called ascites. And I did everything I could to steer clear of that diagnosis, or to completely ignore that diagnosis. You know, I laid out in the sun so that I wouldn't look as yellow. I wore baggy clothes so you couldn't see my belly. I wore shades so you couldn't see how yellow my eyes were.
Holy,
I stayed out of the hospital. I mean, I was in full liver failure for 3 months before I actually went into the hospital, because I just couldn't face the music, you know?
Yeah. Holy. And, that's crazy. So the liver failure happened, and that's not easy to get back from, as well as you have. And then after that, I mean, dogs are great for anything, but recovery for sure. When did the dogs come in, you know, for your recovery? Was it something that you knew that you had an issue at the time, and did you want to get better at that time in your life? Like, where was your head?
Yeah, well, So at that time, the only thing we were focused on as a family was getting me a liver transplant. So it was really just my dad and I living up here in Tehachapi. And I'd been in the hospital for 2 months. I got admitted to the comprehensive transplant program at Cedars-Sinai. And the whole goal was to stay alive long enough to qualify for transplant. I had an 86% chance of death within 90 days without a liver transplant. So I was as sick as you can get. And so I wasn't expected to make it 6 months. But if I wanted to survive 6 months, which is just to get you eligible, in order to be eligible for transplant, you have to have 6 months of sobriety, verified sobriety. So, I got home and things got worse before they got better. You know, I went through full opiate. I got addicted to opiates in the hospital, got addicted to Dilaudid and morphine. And so I had to go through that experience. And that was really my dogs really, really, really helped me get through that because it was so fragile and it almost killed me just because I was so fragile. I couldn't go to the bathroom for myself. I couldn't really walk. I had ammonia on my brain, so I couldn't really stand. I had no balance. And my dogs, you know, the experience of going through like a 2 day long withdrawal, my dogs were in my bed with me and helped keep me grounded. I was full hallucinations. I was seeing serpents and the devil and like all kinds of crazy stuff.
That's crazy.
An awful experience. Yeah.
That's real. Like you kind of see stuff like that in movies, but I don't think I've ever met anybody that actually's gone through something.
I hadn't
like
slept
that.
For like 3 or 4 nights. You know, I didn't sleep for a long time. When I got out of the hospital, I was so addicted that I convinced my dad to drive me to the hospital several times just to get shots of dope, you know, just because I was hurting.
Wow.
You know, and then I finally had to bite the bullet and go through withdrawals. And so after that experience, you know, I had a real aha moment. I had a real epiphany. And I had a couple different epiphanies. One, I had I don't know what your policy is on curse words.
No, we don't have any policies. You can curse all you want.
I had just shit myself in my bed. And so I was completely naked. I couldn't, you know, again, I was taking this stuff called Enulose, which is this, it clears out your system to keep ammonia off your brain. And I lost my bowels and I had to get up and try and, you know, I'm in the bathroom and I'm looking at myself naked and I'm like, I'm 40 pounds lighter than I am now and I'm not a big guy. And I'm completely yellow and I got this huge belly with all these varicose veins, like these purple veins feeding my stomach. And,
dude, it's like a zombie.
I looked like that. And I'm just yellow and purple because you bruise really easily when you're in liver failure. I just looked like that. I didn't recognize myself. I started to cry, you know, and just kind
scary.
Of sob. And I turn around. I could feel my dogs behind me. I turn around, look around, and they're all looking at me like I'm, you know, like the sexiest man alive. Like there's nothing wrong with me. You know, they still recognize my soul, like what still exists in me that is good and that has potential. And so that moment was kind of like a do or die. You know, if I continued to feel sorry for myself, I was just going to end up withering away. And if I got my shit together and started to try and live, really try and live, then there was some hope for me. And so I started to walk my dogs in the morning. I started to journal and started to try and take my dogs out. I couldn't really hold up. If I got pulled over at that time, walking, like if the dogs pulled me too hard, it would have been pretty ugly. So I was walking off leash. And it was real early in the morning. There's this, we're up here in the mountains and I'm walking up and there's the sun's coming up behind this hill that's up at the top of my mountain. And so there's this big shadow being cast from this figure that's coming over the, as the sun is rising. I'm going, is that a bear? Is that a, what is that? Cause we'd done that walk, you know, a few times and I'd done it several times before I got sick and I'd never seen anybody on that walk. So we get closer and it turns out to be this old guy whose name is Wynn, is short for Wendell. And he's by himself and he's like got two parkas on. He's this little 80-year-old man. And I'm like, what the hell is this guy doing out here by himself? You know, because it's kind of bear country, and we have mountain lions, especially at dawn and dusk.
This is in California, is that right?
Yeah.
So like
2 hours north of LA.
2 hours north. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. And so we end up talking to this guy, and he's on this walk, been taking care of his wife for the past 3 years, who had just died of cancer.
Damn.
And he had done that walk with her prior to her getting sick every day for I don't know how many years, right? So this is the first time this guy, who's lost everything, you know, that his life revolved around in his wife, and he's out old as fuck, you know,
yeah,
in mountain lion country at dawn to get his walk in. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, I've been feeling sorry for myself
yeah
every day for the last I don't know how long. And here's this guy who just lost everything that he cares about, and he could be easily sitting at home feeling sorry for himself, crying in his pillow, popping, you know, pain pills or doing whatever to get through the grief. But he's out here working. He's out here working it, and he's out here, you know, getting his life back. And it's so envious. I thought that was so – I mean, he didn't ask any questions about me. He wouldn't let me feel sorry for myself. He just asked about my dogs. He just wanted to know – I mean, I look like the sickest sick person you've ever seen. I look like a walking dead person.
It sounds like
– And he didn't – most people prior to that point had been like, Jesus Christ, what happened to you? You look – you know, you look awful. And he didn't say anything. He just wanted to know who's the black dog, who's the little dog, who's the white dog, you know? And then, so we started doing that walk together, and that really helped me
every day.
Yeah. As often as possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that really helped me, to not feel sorry for myself and to get on the right road. And he ended up buying an RV, selling his house, buying an RV and traveling the country, selling old people vitamins. At old people homes. So, and then he got remarried. He found another wife. It's like
at
25 80? Years younger than him. Yeah.
Wow.
He passed away a couple of years ago. But he sure as shit got his life, you know, back and together. Adapted. And yeah.
So that was another epiphany that you kind of had when you saw. This guy.
His name is Wendell.
Yeah. Wendell.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, if this guy just lost his wife to cancer, is out here. Mm-hmm. Walking, you know, his old bones around, still mm-hmm. killing it. You were like, damn. So that set you back. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. So you went through the liver failure at 28, 29. Uh-huh. Is that right?
Yeah. I got out of the hospital a week before my 29th birthday.
Okay. And then after the 29th birthday, your dog stuck by you. Didn't look at you any different, you know, no matter if you shit your pants or not. And you know, they helped you move forward. And it sounds to me that you were like, look, if I'm going to continue this life, it's going to be, you know, because these guys are pushing me to do it, which then maybe in return in the future is, you know, part of the reason why you give back to them now. Is that?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
So, cool, man. That's crazy. So after that, your dogs have helped you got through that, and you got through
all that stuff. Well, the real miracle was that I got to 6 months sobriety. I wasn't supposed to make it 90 days. I ended up getting to 6 months sobriety in so much better shape than I was when I got out of the hospital that my numbers, if you graphed it on a chart in terms of my numbers getting better, it was a dramatic increase, so that my numbers just got – I had to get tested every week, in the beginning twice a week.
Like drug tested?
Blood tested to make sure that my – I was so fragile that I could go into complete kidney failure or liver failure at really any time. And I had pancreatitis and my gallbladder was swollen and I had kidney stones, all kinds of weird shit.
Jeez.
So, you know, so you're getting tested constantly. And at first it was just like, he's not going to make it. This is – they talked about sending me home on hospice at the hospital anyway.
Damn. And like, at 28 years old?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Did you, Zach, have a significant other at the time, or were you living by yourself, or
my
what?
My dad was my significant other.
Cool. Did he help you out through this process?
He's just an engineer, yeah. He was just, you know, when I first got admitted to the hospital, the doctor said, you know, your son needs a transplant and he's not going to get one. You know, so.
That's scary.
That's your
Imagine
reality.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Okay.
Yeah, that was my reality. And so he just set to trying to make it happen, to get me to wherever I needed to be so that I would get the help that I needed. And what really ended up, it wasn't any sort of modern medicine. They took me off most of my medication, which was really helpful when I got admitted to the program at Cedars, which is all, ironically where I was born.
Wow, full circle, man.
Yeah, for sure. And so by the time I got 6 months, I didn't need a liver transplant. And there's not anybody, there's 0.5% of liver disease patients have the ability to, of cirrhosis patients actually have the ability to regenerate healthy new liver tissue. Cirrhosis is scarring of the liver. So typically when you are end, especially when you're end stage, you die or you get a transplant. That's what happens to you.
So you didn't.
I didn't die or get a transplant. Yeah, I ended up making it, and then I've just gotten better and better and better and better and better. It's been almost 10 years now since I got admitted. I got admitted August 3rd, 2008. And yeah, so I don't even have cirrhosis of the liver anymore. I have this thing called a fibrosis scan, and the FibroScan, you know, confirms for the last 3 years that I no longer have cirrhosis, which is like a miracle.
Wow, man. So it rebuilt. It rebuilt everything. Your liver and your kidneys and everything rebuilt itself, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. My kidneys. You know, your kidneys are a much more delicate, different thing than your liver. They're not regenerative like your liver. But
right.
My kidneys were in such a state because of my liver. So once my liver improved, my kidney function improved. So luckily I was not on dialysis. You know, I didn't achieve like a really progressive state of kidney failure, but my kidneys were just shot because my liver was shot.
Right. It just went downhill from there.
Yeah. And so ever since then, you know, like I had my comprehensive review twice a year where I have to go to Cedars and they look at all my imaging and my blood work and they talk to me and they feel my stomach and look at my abdominal. I have to go for a cancer screening every 6 months. And wow. Yeah, they're just basically baffled, you know, that this doesn't happen to people, that we never see, especially when your numbers have been that high, we don't ever see that kind of reversal. So damn. I'm definitely a lucky, lucky dude. And it wasn't because of modern medicine. It wasn't because of, I mean, it was definitely because I'm in a program of sobriety, and it was definitely because I found purpose in life. It's definitely because I'm plugged into something greater than myself. It's definitely because I have a God of my understanding, which I'm not ashamed to use the word God, even as an atheist, you know, sure. Growing up profoundly atheistic,
yeah.
And agnostic, you know, I'm not afraid to talk about God, who has nothing to do with Jesus, who has nothing to do with, you know, Allah or Buddha, or, you know, maybe has a lot to do with all of them.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a higher
power.
Right.
Having something in your life that you are plugged into that isn't you.
Wow, dude. You know? That's the podcast, everybody. No, I'm kidding. That's pretty remarkable, though. That's a story in itself. That's insane. Well, you know, before I forget, you know, congratulations and all of that, because that is, I mean, you probably were mentally just, you know, ready to just not be here anymore, I could imagine.
Oh, man, that's the thing we should talk about, man, because everyone hears my story. They go, oh, what a courageous,
yeah,
what a courageous, like, what a strong guy. And it was the opposite of that. There was very little,
I can see that,
self-born strength coming from me. I didn't wake up every morning and go, like, let's seize the day.
Right.
No, it was more like, if my dogs don't get my ass up out of bed, I'm just going to, you know, very little, like I had lost all fight. My focus was on, especially in the beginning, was just on trying to be high. I didn't want to be around, and I just didn't know how to live with all the feelings that were coming up. I didn't know how to address all the shame. I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't look in the mirror. It was like, if I didn't have my dad, you know, and my dogs, then and the program, there would be no me, period. This would not, if this whole spiel, this whole life journey depended on my stick-to-itiveness and my gumption, we would have failed within like week one.
Wow. So your dogs and your dad, you know, saved your life. I don't ever want to, you know, be in that position, but I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there that, you know somebody, or, you know, what's going through your mind when your body is literally shutting down? And
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting what goes through your mind. There's a level of vanity that you're combating, like your cultural vanity, which you don't realize how central vanity is to some of how you perceive the world until you look scary. You know, and
physically.
When you look scary, physically scary.
Yeah.
And when how you look affects other people in a visceral way, it's a weird position to be in, because you don't want to be out in public. You don't want to, it makes it hard to even try to get better because it freaks people out. I mean, it was tough for me to go to meetings because people were so taken back by the way I looked that they didn't want to get close to me and get close to somebody that was going to die. You know, it was very real. It was very, very, very real. I mean, I had a difficult time talking sometimes. I didn't know where I was sometimes. I was very, very weird looking, you know.
How long did you look like that after you were out of the hospital?
Well, probably from about April before I went into the hospital, I didn't look very, very good. And then certainly until through December of 2000. So basically a good portion of the year 2008. And then right around January, February of 2009, I really started I took after physical fitness and wellness like I took after alcohol and drugs. I did everything I could to, I worked out every night. Because I finally gotten the ability. At first, I could barely walk. So you had to walk and then maybe hike. And then you can jog and then you can run. Mm-hmm. And then so at that point, you know, 8 months later, 8 months after diagnosis, I could run. Yeah. And so I was starting to do things. So I got rapidly better. Like that's the thing that impressed me the most about the human body is just how truly quickly you can metamorphosize what you thought was a rut that you'd be in forever.
Yeah.
You know,
because of how you
like
felt,
how quickly you, if you apply yourself, you change the way you eat. That's a big thing that they don't ever really talk about in liver. When you have liver disease, you know, they'll talk about salt. Don't eat a lot of salt, you know, reduce your red meat consumption and try not to eat, you know, processed meat, but they don't really talk to you about what you can do proactively to help yourself and how much fiber you need and how many vegetables you need and how you shouldn't be eating red meat and how you shouldn't cut out salt and how you shouldn't eat sugars, you know, and complex carbohydrates, which are all processed in the liver and, mm-hmm. and all these things that you need to stick away from or else you're going to stay sick.
Yeah.
And we have such a terrible diet in this country today that
yeah.
I think 95% of people that are in liver failure don't ever even have close to a shot of getting better because they don't realize that, the potential even exists. If people knew from right out of the gate that, hey, listen, you're in liver failure, here are the things you can do that will really drastically affect your life. You can get out and move, you know, you can move your body, walk, jog, do whatever you need to do, get on a stationary bike, walk your dogs, and then radically look at what it is that you put in your body. You know, if you put shit in your body, you're going to get shit mm-hmm. out. And when you're that fragile, when you're so fragile that, I mean, I ate a handful of McDonald's fries like 2 months after I got out of the hospital, and just the salt content in that sent me into basically like an episode of liver failure where my stomach started to, when you have ascites, when you're in liver failure, your stomach fills with bile and blood that your liver isn't processing. So you have this huge 9 months pregnant belly that's swashing around. You can see all the liquid in it.
Damn.
And then you have to,
that's
you
crazy.
Have to get it, you have to get it drained. Which is called a paracentesis. So they cut a hole in you, stick a big ass suction tube in there and suck all the shit out of your body. And if you drink salt, if you consume salt, that condition worsens considerably. But people don't really know. I mean, the reason I got better is because I gave myself a shot, you know?
Yeah. And your dogs kind of rose you up and got you out of that. And that's incredible. So
yeah. The person that was responsible for nearly killing me, it was me. And the person that was going to continue to try and kill me, it was me. And the more I got out of my own head and into something else where I could live for my dogs, I could live for, I just didn't, you know, I mean, the brutal truth of it all mm-hmm. is I just didn't think I was worth saving, you know, but my dogs did. And my dad,
right.
Did.
That what an, that's incredible. You know? Yeah, no, that's incredible. I could see, you know, there's a commercial that could partially mentally relate to anybody out there that's listening that maybe they can get a better visual. There's a commercial that really hit home with me once. And I want to say it was Budweiser, one of those bigger beer brands. And the owner and the dog were hanging out. It was just like a bromance type thing. And he went out with his buddies, and it was like this montage of him drinking and then him not coming home because he got into an accident and his dog waiting for him.
Yeah.
Dude, and for me, I was like, you know, and I don't drink and drive, like, ever, and I encourage people to never do that. However, you know, it happens every day. And that for me, even though I don't do it, was like so emotionally, because your dogs are depending on you or looking for you. And so that's kind of what it was like for you, it seems.
My dad used to tell me every day before he would leave the hospital, every night before he would leave, he would tell me, son, you got to come home. I can't get Tug to come in the fucking house. meaning that the dog is sitting on the driveway, looking down the driveway, waiting for me to come home.
Dude, yeah.
So he would tell me that every night, you know, hey, kiddo, I need you to come home. I can't get Tug to come in the house.
That's enough. That would be enough for me, I feel. Yeah. And I think like mentally with my love with dogs, if somebody were to say your dog wants you to come home or they were sitting there crying and waiting, I think I would be able to. I say that, but I haven't gone through a fraction of the shit that you've gone through. But
yeah, it's weird when you're possessed with like the demon of addiction. It's funny when we talk about drinking and driving. I didn't drive sober for more than a decade. Every single time I got behind the wheel, I was intoxicated. And I was intoxicated all the time. So I had to drive. Mm-hmm. So I was intoxicated. I mean, I wasn't shit faced, but I was.
My
tolerance was through the roof. You know, so what would have gotten someone else passed out completely? I might have not been barely affected.
Give me an example. But I drank.
Oh, I mean, I could drink. When my liver failed, I was drinking a box of wine a day, which is like 5 liters of wine
a day.
So that's like 8 bottles.
Damn.
Yeah. From the time I woke. So if I went to bed at midnight, I would wake up at 2, chug an entire solo cup of wine. Wake up at 4, chug an entire solo cup of wine. Wake up at 6, chug an entire solo cup of wine. Just chug it. Warm wine. Just chug a full red solo cup.
Because I had to.
Oh, I would go into withdrawals within like 4 or 5 hours.
Damn. You know,
I'm really feeling like.
It's brutal.
Yeah, really, really feeling uncomfortable. You get very, even more uncomfortable in your skin than you already are. You start to get nauseous. You get really, really shaky. You know, and then the longer you wait, the worse it gets. There's a intense kind of paranoia. There's this feeling like, you know, you're just going to burst. So you really, really shake like crazy. You get real sweaty and vomity, and like, you know, you just, you know what you need. I mean, as an alcoholic, you just don't ever get to that point. You try to make sure that you're covered, that you have alcohol to get you through. You know, you plan out your whole day based around, it's just like narcotics. I mean, if you're dependent on heroin, you're going to plan out your day to get the fix you need to, so that you can subsist. And that's how it was with me. I always knew how much alcohol I had. I always knew where I had it hidden. I always knew who I could count on for help. I always, you know.
Yeah. That's fucking crazy. Wow. Okay. So Marley's Mutts came out of all of that. How did you decide? I know that your dog saved your life, which is beautiful. How did you then decide that you were going to create a organization that is dedicated to saving dogs that are in danger?
Yeah, it was pretty. Everything was organic. I didn't plan on this. This is not what I wanted to do in life. You know, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. my dad's an aeronautical engineer, so that's what I always wanted to do. And, cool. There's one thing led to another, and we had been rehabilitating large dogs. Every other rescue at the time, you know, this is 10 years ago, were breed specific, or the vast majority of them were breed specific. So mm-hmm. we had some here. We have a Doberman rescue, and then we had, a golden retriever rescue, but there's nothing for mutts, which I spent a lot of time in the shelter working with the Humane Society, and everything I saw were pit bull mixes and chihuahua mixes and American shelter dogs, you know? And my dog Marley did such a great job helping me command a pack, helping enforce the rules. He kept his harmony. The dog possessed everything I wanted to be. It's funny how the my interpersonal dichotomy, like the person who I wanted to be and the person I actually was totally manifested in my dogs. So Marley was everything I visualized wanting to be. He's this Rottweiler pit bull that just commanded respect. He didn't start fights, but he would negotiate them down. He knew the rules. He just like other dogs wanted to be around him, you know, boys and girls. I'm like, you know,
yep.
Like he just, and then Tug, my other dog, was fucking terrified of everything. Just people, places, and things. He's a white Labrador,
yep.
Like mix, you know, and he was scared of everything, which is what Dad was, scared of everything, you know, and if you scared him enough, then he's going to punch you in the face and then run away.
Yeah.
So it's funny how that was my, those are my dogs. But Marley just had this instinctual ability to help rehabilitate, insecure dogs and kind of tame the pack. And, you know, I was building that pack up. Sometimes I had 10 dogs in there, you know, lived in the garage of my dad's place, and we started to build some kennels and the work was really unique because we were doing work for mutts. We were doing work for for the underdog, for dogs that weren't forgotten. I mean, we weren't going after purebred golden retrievers, and you know, we were trying to help dogs that were like us, that was like me, that were
right.
throwaway dogs, and then it just really worked out. I didn't even come up with a name. That was one of the employees at the pet lodge came up with that name, and so it just continued to kind of grow out of control. People wanted to be a part of it, and I worked on trying to help people. When you're starting a nonprofit organization, it's difficult, man. You don't know the first thing about where to start, how to follow through, how to, you know, you got to get your bylaws and your board of directors and your secretary and your treasurer and your, and you got to get all these things organized, and you got to have money to apply for status, and you got to have do all this stuff. And it just kind of addressed it one thing at a time. I mean, really how it started was just making posters. I made adoption posters with good pictures and ridiculous stories that would, you know, so I tried to humanize the dogs through these funny stories. And I just put, this is, it wasn't pre-social media. I just didn't use social media much then. So I just put my posters up everywhere. I taped them to walls and to windows everywhere. And that was my routine, was I'd add dogs to my pack, get them adopted, and then post adoption flyers all over town. And then that worked, and people started to take attention. And I had little tin donation receptacles all over town. I panhandled at AA meetings for adoption
for adoption
for
money,
spay and neuter money. For spay and neuter money, and it just continued to grow. And then we started to add programs. You know, as the years went by, we added the first thing we added was a therapy wing. You know, or an educational wing where I would go out and bring Marley and talk about the challenges of being a pit bull in today's society, and let people really humanize the breed, because he's a black, intimidating looking pit bull, you know, and I bring him to schools and all over the place and tell my story. And then that's become the Miracle Mutts program, which we have our own curriculum called Pledge, Positive Leadership and Empathy.
What is this program now? I missed it.
It's called Pledge, Positive Leadership and Empathy for Dog Guardians. Mm-hmm. And so we take that out to kids all over the place and to different institutions. We've been to over 120 different nonprofit organizations and schools where we've brought our team of therapy dogs that we use for education and for – these are all dogs that have been certified through our organization. So they've been CGC certified and then therapy certified as Miracle Mutts.
Miracle Mutts. That's what I was looking for. Yeah,
to go out through our community and educate and really just
so what's
promote
your,
the human canine bond.
That's fantastic. So the Miracle Mutts is your own therapy course, therapy dog course.
We therapy certify dogs. So say you've adopted a Marley's Mutt and you want to get that dog therapy certified, and so certified to go into different institutions and places, schools, wherever to educate or be therapeutic. You have to go through our training course with Liz Cover, who's our Canine Assisted Activities Director. You have to pass the Canine Good Citizen certification, and then you have to put in 40 hours of community service in any of our programs, which are, we have a 12-step program at the Mission. We have Barks and Books, which is a reading program for kids with developmental disabilities. We have programs at New Advances for people with disabilities, at Mountain Pathways, at like any, you know,
that's great.
Any place you can imagine we go, any place you can, the juvenile hall, bring dogs, we do it.
And do you guys do the same protocols of like TDI, Therapy Dog International?
You know, essentially, yeah. I mean, what you have to do in order to become therapy certified is the same baseline certification that everybody needs, which is your Canine Good Citizen, which is a 10-point test that requires, you know, you to demonstrate your proficiency. And then to follow through on that proficiency, in order to become therapy certified, you have to put in 40 hours of actual therapy work where you're going out in the community with our team to schools and all these different places. And then different dogs get different designations. So some dogs we can't bring into schools for autistic kids because it's too overwhelming.
Yeah.
Some dogs we can bring anywhere. They get different labels, different levels of proficiency, and we apply by all the same guidelines.
That's fantastic. I actually got asked to do a talk about not necessarily therapy dogs, but how dogs make the workplace and at academic place just a better environment, I guess. And
yeah,
so I'm gonna go and do that, and that's gonna
we take our dogs to finals.
Good. So
our dogs go to finals week at BC and CSUB, Cal State University Bakersfield.
That's awesome.
So the kids are stressed out of their minds.
They can imagine.
Go to the little puppy petting zoo and
take a deep breath and get the test done. That's fantastic.
Yeah. We also did a, we raised a therapy dog for Hoffman Hospice. So our big local hospice company has one of our dogs, Maggie, who lives there.
Wow.
That's and we're cool. working on a funeral home also.
Yeah, I've done that before. I trained a dog to do like, I guess therapeutic type work at funeral homes.
Yeah.
Sometimes that.
Yeah. Be a dog, right? Like.
Yeah. Exactly.
Be present.
Not
and be
too
a dog.
Hard.
Yeah.
Just live and, you know, don't jump on everybody. Pretty much.
Spread the love. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really really cool. And then you're also involved. I was talking to John of I Pity the Bull last week, and you're involved in the Positive Change Program. Did you create that as well, or is that something that you kind of joined in on, or?
No, that's our program. So Positive Change, which is our inmate canine training program, is Marley's Mutt's program. And so we looped John in probably a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. We've been doing it for 2 years and, I don't know, two years and a quarter, basically.
Yeah.
And, that was the whole team, you know, helped make that happen. You know, Lisa Porter, who's one of our head trainers, and Leah Marquez. And it's something we were trying to do 4 years ago after our buddy Robbie got out of prison. Mm-hmm. He adopted one of our dogs, and we tried to get a variety of different institutions that just weren't ready to commit. And then so finally we had an institution that was ready to commit, and we jumped on it.
Awesome.
And then with such a great group of trainers, we've got programs in four different prisons. Corcoran State Prison, which is, you know, one of the most notorious prisons in California, which is high security level 4 180 prison, which is the most secure in America.
Yeah.
And two other max security prisons, North Kern and Wasco, and then California City Correctional Facility. We're also working on a juvenile program here in Bakersfield, and also another program that we're really trying to get started here locally at the Tehachapi State Prison. So, yeah, we've been doing that for almost 2.5 years now, and we've rehabilitated, hundreds of inmates and hundreds of dogs, and it's it is by far the most wonderful thing I've ever been a part of in life. I really truly feel like I found my calling. I think John, to a degree, also has, to just watch.
He's a great dude.
To be able, he's an awesome dude. I owe him 5 compliments throughout the course of this interview, I promised him.
I love that
compliment
dude.
Level has to meet his compliment level. Yeah. No, he's a great guy, and that's the thing that Positive Change has done, is just brought a lot of really wonderful people together who want to make a difference.
Yeah.
And I mean, John drives like 3.5 hours to get to Corcoran. You know, program starts at 8:30, so he leaves his house at like 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, and same with Angela Aiden, you know, who's a wonderful trainer. She is coming from Santa Barbara area, and all the prisons we go to are far away for us, you know. And
that says that says a lot about their personality. I mean, think about it; they're driving 3 to 4 hours to prison
mm-hmm.
to help. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's weird. There's no place I'd rather be.
Right.
And I'm fairly confident that our whole group would say that there's no place that I would rather be than inside of a prison, working with these dogs and these men. By far, I mean, there's nothing that blows my hair back more. There's nothing that I feel more strongly about as far as being when you finally whether it's religion, whether it's your family, whether it's Mother Earth, whether it's the great blue sky, whatever it is that you connect in, mm-hmm. that you truly feel a part of, when you feel a part of something greater than yourself, like the work that you do not only has purpose but instills hope in other people, you know, brings where you when you find yourself able to bring light into a truly dark place of yourself, of your own vulnerability, of really where your own vulnerability and your own expression of yourself brings people hope and light. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like being a person like myself who's grown up hating myself for so many years, having such a deeply worn neural pathway of self-loathing, that to actually use my self-loathing, my experience
to help
strength and hope, what I've been through, to bring hope to other people is like a true confirmation of oneself. It finally lets me know that I'm okay with who I am, that who I am, it can still be inspirational, that who I am is okay, that who I am can make the difference in these people's lives. And if I continue to open up and I continue to share my experience, then it's only going to get better. And there's only going to be more of an impact. And like, it really, the connections that we make in prison are so, you know, are so amazing. It's some of the most profound connection you can have in life. You know, it's a type of like unique love. It really is.
Yeah. And I was talking to John about it too, and he was saying, that you guys are in some pretty high security prisons. And, now, Zach, are there any pushbacks that you get from the inmates? You know, because some of these guys just don't give a shit about anything. Not the guys that you particularly work with. I'm just saying, but there are obviously other inmates in the prison. So do you ever get nervous situations where, you know?
No, I mean, well, the first time you go into a new prison, probably, I mean, it's prison. So you're walking in, and usually we're unaccompanied because we are brown card holders. We are basically employees of the state. So we accompany ourselves to the facility. So
you're not even protected by security? Really?
Depending on which prison we're at, no.
Damn.
So we'll, you know, depending on where Cal City, we're not. And when we're at Corcoran, we always are. But still, and you know, I don't know. Sometimes when we're on the yard training, where every inmate that's on the yard, which can be hundreds and hundreds of inmates, sometimes they'll line up against the fence. They'll watch us doing stuff. And like at California City, I remember one time where they were hollering at a lot of the guys in the program, trying to poke fun and make fun. And then by the end of it, they were like, wow, this is impressive. Look at what these guys are doing.
Nice.
This is really, really cool. So the level of respect that the program has inside of the prison is pretty much second to none. The guys that are involved in the dog program won't let anything bad, not only not won't let anything bad happen to the dogs, but they generally are better behaved in terms of dealing drugs, having conflicts. When the dogs are on the yard, they cease and desist.
The whole yard or just the guys you work with?
No, that the areas that whenever the area of the prison that the dogs are operating in, the guys are much more conscious of what's going on. They're much more respectful. The pods are cleaner. Drug dealing is minimized. Incidents, meaning violent incidents, are decreased. Like, there's all kinds of byproducts of having the dogs on the yard.
Do you think that's because dogs just bring a certain humanity to people, and they get distracted by, you know, some of the things they're surrounded with? Yeah.
Totally, and also because the people that are in the program are respected. So a lot of the guys we have in the program are people that are respected within the institution. And so
wow,
the other
cool
thing is that they're all working outside of their race. So if it were an all-white program, then we would have problems.
Be
if
in
it
trouble.
Were an all-black program, we'd have problems. But this is the only program really within the facility where on the yard, but within visibility, everyone can see people working together. You know, prisons in California are strictly segregated.
Yeah.
Very strictly segregated. The Northerners, Southerners, Blacks, Whites, Asians, you know, they're separate. So our program is very much so diverse. And so it's really the only place that out in public you can see people of other races working together.
And I'm sure the people that work or the administration of the prison, they notice that and appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it definitely increases communication between correctional staff. One of the main reasons being because a lot of them adopt the dogs. A lot of the correctional staff adopt the dogs, and they're just working more closely together to fill the dogs' needs.
That's cool.
So that means, you know, that means that they're communicating better, and they're, you know, the real goal is to like humanize these guys. You know, a number of different epiphanies throughout the course of this program where we have 3 million people incarcerated. 3 million people, which for the most part are going to be kept in this vicious cycle are just parked at the end of a life cul-de-sac that won't let them go anywhere. And I mean, there are some exceptions, right? Like some people have the ability to upwardly move, or most of them downwardly move. But what they really are is you got 3 million sources of potential that were just complicit and stagnating.
Yeah.
We're just saying, we don't want any of these people to have a future necessarily. We're going to make it very easy for you to go back to prison. We're not going to prepare you to be released. And the other funny thing is that these guys are so poorly prepared for when they are released. And we have all this new legislation that's releasing these guys early. Mm-hmm. And they're for the most part, they're just better criminals. They're not emotionally prepared one iota for life on the outside. And our program very, very much so focuses on becoming emotionally prepared for life in the real world and being able to employ yourself in the pet services industry.
Yeah.
But we just, you know, we if these guys go out and commit a crime, I'm surprised it's not, you know, the state of whichever prison incarcerated them isn't being charged with the crime, because we're sending tens of hundreds of thousands of people back on the streets so ill prepared for coping with life that they are bound to create victims. And those victims, you know, it's hard not to say that the state itself is responsible for those victims, is partially responsible for those victims. Clearly, an individual carries out a crime, and that crime is for the most part on them. But when you don't give them much of an option at surviving, at just baseline survival, you know,
it's a vicious cycle. And that's you know, and I think you know, there's so many gray areas, and I think in the, it's just in society in general, but when you're dealing with, it's tough playing God sometimes and telling people where they can live, where they can't, how long they have to stay in this one room. It could be 20, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very gray area, I think.
I mean, we're spending $47,000 a year per inmate in the state of California to employ these people. We're employing an astronomical amount of correctional people and probation officers and all these people associated with just huge industries of employment, and all these industries are you know, industries with great retirement and pensions and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
All around just incarcerating people, you know, and we're not preparing them in any way, shape, or form for their release, so or very minimally, and I don't know, we're due for a considerable overhaul of the criminal justice system. We've been overdue for it for a long time, and I think a critical cog in that process is having dog programs at every prison.
Yeah, I mean, John and I were kind of talking about it a little bit, and there is a difference too when these incarcerated prisoners are actually released. There is a difference in the statistics of them actually coming back, and you know, they actually get a good, decent job and continue to work with dogs, is what John was saying. That's really
totally.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, we have a number of guys that are absolutely going to be kick-ass trainers when they get out. And yeah, that's the whole thing, is part of it is hope. I mean, if you incarcerate someone for 15 years, most of our guys have been in for more than 10 years. So jeez, if they're incarcerated for that long with really no hope for what they're going to do when they're released, I mean, how many of them can become short order cooks and you know, mm-hmm. air conditioning mechanics? Like, it's just not possible. But within the pet services industry, you know, it's a $100 billion a year industry, right? With everything from welfare, animal welfare to shelter work to rescue to Petco and PetSmart to training to whatever. You know, there's all these potential opportunities. And even if they didn't become dog trainers, just the emotional awareness required to be an effective trainer. I mean, what we stress is dog psychology, which is a focus on one's own energy. And if you're not being brutally frank with what you're feeling, you're not going to be an effective dog trainer. If you're not identifying your fears, if you're not identifying your anxieties or whatever it is that you're feeling inside, if you go into trying to train a reserve borderline feral dog into coming out of its skin, you're sure shit not going to do that if you're neurotic, over self-focused, stressed out. You know, you have to identify what you feel. Take some breaths, press the reset button, talk to somebody about what you feel before you want to circle back with your dog. And that's something they just don't do in prison until our program.
And I think too, you know, from what I've seen, I got into the dog world very organically as well. And, you know, I really felt as if, you know, what I do now is still an organic, like, I'm doing this because it feels right type thing. And I think that some of the feral or aggression or aggressive or, you know, more or less reactive dogs, or let's just put it this way, dogs that are unwanted because of their behavior, we'll call it that, to make it really easy. I think people like the people that you're working with, or like I know myself and people who have been in, you know, some pretty shitty places that understand where these dogs are at mentally, knowing, hey, you know, it's not always rainbows and butterflies for these dogs, and they're acting this way for a reason. And I think when you work with intent and passion, and especially with animals, because there's a lot of, I do a certification program at my facility as well. I certify dog trainers for the Animal Behavioral College. So I basically polish up at the end of their literature work.
Cool.
But there's only, I guess my point is there's only there's a limit and the end of the rope of, you know, reading all the information about the dog's behavior, but actually having intent and working with the dogs emotionally and passionately, I think really makes a difference. And some of these people that you're working with are very, very passionate, I'm sure, after your program of, you know, this, I'm this dog's only hope. I got to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They genuinely intuitively connect with the dogs.
Yeah.
Like I don't know that I don't, this is a double negative for you. I don't not believe in animal communication. I genuinely believe that there are certain people that can, you know, kind of intuitively relate, connect, share information with animals. It's not something I'm capable of doing. However, I am capable of being intuitive and vulnerable and available, right? Like you just said, if you're just training a dog to train a dog and go through the motions and cross off the list, then you may or may not have success. But like, you're right. A lot of these guys, their empathy is a good word. They empathize with these dogs. These dogs come from a cage.
Yeah.
These guys are kept in a cage. These dogs are unwanted. These guys are unwanted, and they genuinely feel that, and they generally relate that. I have experience with my horses. My wife has a horse. Mm-hmm. We have another retired horse up here that someone retired up here so that we can basically pay for our horse. And I've been wanting affection from these damn horses since they moved in a couple of weeks ago. And I finally had a little moment, and I thought, you know, I need to go out there and just stand with them and let them know that I don't need affection from them, that I'm just trying to push. I was just trying to get something from them, that I don't need it. Mm-hmm. And that I'm here to feed them and care for them and try and walk confidently amongst them. I had this conversation with both of them, and I swear to God, the next day, cause neither of them would come up to me really. They're like, what the fuck is this guy want? You know? And then the next day there was such a shift in the way both of them viewed me. It's so interesting to see. I mean, it's been like that ever since. I took the burden off myself. Like I went out of my way to kind of, all right, let me put myself in their shoes for a second.
Yep.
Which, you know, we
just be.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That's it. And a lot of people, exactly kind of what you're saying, I'm highlighting the idea of people just wanting to get a certification to work with dogs. And I've run into them where I tell people, hey, you know, I can't teach you how to be passionate. I can't teach you how to care. I can't teach you empathy. I can't teach you these things. You have to feel it. And if you don't feel it, you won't be successful with the dog. And a lot of people want to go out and just play with puppies all day, and that's what they think it is. And sometimes they get that job working at that training camp, and they play with puppies all day, and they teach them some things. But you know, actually teaching a dog how to be better behaviorally and teach them how to live a better life is really what I prefer to do, because a lot of the dogs that I work with are behaviorally challenged. And I think you're right. I think there's going back to your horse thing, there's a lot of people who get into a room with a dog and say, love me. You have to love me because I love dogs and I'm good with dogs.
I'm having a hard day too. Life has hit the fan.
Hug me.
And you know, I've had a hard day at work and I need some sort of affirmation.
And
have you had the experience that your dogs really show you what you're afraid of? Or, you know, that's my experience, especially lately, in an effort to be more empathetic to working with certain difficult dogs. I have realized that the energy I'm bringing forward isn't at the place I want to be. Yeah. And that it's not something even that I can fix immediately, that I'm going to have to do my best in this moment. But then I have much bigger things in life in terms of fears that I've allowed to resurface that I have to address if I'm really hoping to be the best me. This happened recently, like the other day, working with one of our dogs. Ironically, it's a boy whose name is Bliss. And he's the opposite of blissful. He is a pain in the ass.
Yep.
And I really realized, like, hey, Zach, you've got some fears bubbling up. This dog is clearly picking up off of you some anxieties, fears, anxieties, whatever people feel comfortable using, you know, euphemistically.
Yep.
And let me really know, like, I need to go back and get within myself and focus on what I'm afraid of, acknowledge it and deflate deflate the air from it.
Yeah. I think to answer your question, I think, dogs, you know, my personal dogs, they definitely show me things. And I think they just slow things down. I think that that's kind of like what you're saying is, anyway, what my perspective of it is they slow things down for me, which means if I get, you know, really excited about something, or I get really sad, or really, you know, something, if my attitude or my behavior changes, they usually stay the same, and it grounds me a bit. You know, like if you get a really great phone call from a big opportunity, or you get a really shitty phone call from somebody saying, you know, a really shitty thing, they're kind of just like, and, you know, on either end of the spectrum. And that's really helped me a lot, too. And I think the clients that I work with, the dogs that I work with anyway, have definitely helped me remain grounded. And, you know, the owner will come in and say all of these bad things about the dog, and the dog and I are just looking at each other like, okay, when you're done, we'll start working together.
Yeah,
I see that a lot.
Isn't that funny how working with dogs, not to be so judgmental of people, because it's our nature to be like, God, that person's an asshole. What a dick. Wow. You know, or, you know, this, I had an interaction with so-and-so or whatever, and God, what a dick, what an asshole. As opposed to like, boy, what must that person's life be like? What must their day be like that causes them to behave like assholes?
It all transfers. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I see that a lot. If a dog comes in a certain way, I know exactly how the person is. And I've actually been really registering that a lot mentally, that if the dog comes in a certain way, chances are the person is going to be exactly what they played out to be.
Well, what I also mean, though, is like we have a tendency to say, you know, if someone's a jerk or that person is an asshole. Sometimes the dog comes in and they're reactive. We say, oh, this dog is an asshole.
Yeah.
And so by having to be, because I don't have a choice, you know, in the line of work we're in, I can't look at the dog as being an asshole. So mm-hmm. you have to really kick in your empathy, and you have to say, all right, well, what might this dog be experiencing? What really put yourself in their shoes. So what it's done is given me a lot more tolerance for actual assholes in the world.
Definitely.
I can think of you know, where what must their day be like, what must their life be like that has brought them to this point, as opposed to focusing on just how their negative energy affects me.
Definitely. I mean, I tell the shadow trainers that that I work with on a daily basis to really watch that. And that's the thing I've started to develop, and that's why I love talking to people like yourself and John and other people within the industry that think similar to what I do. Is I tell my shadow students, don't watch the dog, watch the owner. Don't worry about the dog. The dog will follow whatever you do later. Don't worry about that. The dog you can fix. Just watch the owner. Mm-hmm. And somebody will come in and they'll be, blah, 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 and then my neighbor's dog and my old dog, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden you look down at the dog.
Story, story, story,
story. Yeah. My neighbor's dog, my old dog, my past dog, my other dog. And I'm like falling asleep, and I'm like, oh, wait, can we start? Now, and then same thing, like I had a guy come in the other day, the dog was super reactive, just typical flat collared leash dog, just reactive. I think it was like a shepherd. And the wife was, it's always role play, right? So the wife was like, oh, this is really scary. I can't walk. We're expecting, so on and so forth. Very typical. And then the dad's like, well, I really think that the dog should defend himself and stick up and tell another dog off and bite another dog if they get in his space. And I'm like, oh, this explains a lot, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're exactly right. It's empathy of, okay, slow down, take a deep breath. You know, what's really wrong here? What's really wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a truly, probably having more success than a therapist in someone's life.
Yep. You know? I say that to people. I usually get the question, very often do I get the question, do you train kids? Do you train husbands? Do you train wives? You know, because I slow their life down. It's exactly what I do. They come in with all of these issues, and all of these issues to their dog is whack-a-mole and popping up other places as well. It's popping into work. It's popping into their relationship at home with their family. And I think that that's naturally what happens, is the dog is the easiest target, because you're not going to blame your kids or your significant other of why you're so stressed and insecure and, you know, whatever. And I think the dogs are just the easiest target to do it on. And then when the dog comes in and the dog and I are looking at each other like, what the hell is going on? It just makes so much more sense. And that's where I do like a lot of my public speaking, and people come in and I'm like, hey, it's not your dog. It's really, really not, you know, slow things down. and it makes a lot of sense to them.
Yeah, definitely.
So, all right, man. Well, I appreciate you so much for jumping on the phone call with me today, Zach. And I'm going to let you go. I know you're a busy man. You got a lot going on.
Yeah, this was fun, man. I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, no worries. And then, like John and I talked before, if there's ever any opportunity or room out in California for me to come watch some of the programs you guys do, I'd love to do that. And for anybody out there that wants to kind of see a little bit more of what Zach does, you can follow him at Marley's Mutts, and you can follow what the Positive Change program on Instagram too as well, right?
Yeah. Marley's Mutts on Facebook and Instagram. I'm just Zach Scow on Facebook and Instagram, and then Positive Change, PAWSITIVE, on Facebook and Instagram. And yeah, man, if you want to come out here, you know, we have a rescue ranch that we are developing and populating, and we have extra bedrooms out there that will shortly be filled with furniture. And if you want to come out and come, you know, check out the prison, you know, one of a variety of different prisons out here, or you know, work on how we amend our curriculum or anything like that, man, we'd love to have you.
Love to, man. Thank you so much. And thanks for being on the show. Congratulations with all your success. And, you know, it's a true inspiration to hear your story. And we'll talk soon, brother.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. I appreciate it, man.
All right, Zach. See you, man. So thanks again, Zach, for joining the show. And thank you guys at home or in the car, traveling on an airplane, for listening to me banter with my friends in the dog industry. If you haven't yet, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Smash the subscription and download button on our No Bad Dogs podcast. And thank you guys again for following along. Talk to you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.